welcome to the Slow Flowers Podcast with Deborah Prinzing, episode 152. This is the podcast about American flowers and the people who grow and design with them. It's all about making a conscious choice, and I invite you to join the conversation and the creative community. This podcast is brought to you by slowflowers.com, the free nationwide online directory to florists, shops, and studios who design with American-grown flowers, and to the farms that grow those blooms. As we launch this podcast's second year, I'm honored to continue bringing great conversations to you each week. Some of the most rewarding side benefits of interviewing flower farmers, floral designers, and other influential voices in the field to vase floral industry are the field trips. The field trips that bring me close up and in person to see the sources of our American flowers, the farms, the studios, and the retail spaces where such amazing beauty connects us with nature and with the seasons. This happened again last week when I invited myself to Everyday Flowers in Stanwood, Washington, for a quick 24-hour visit. Owned by veteran grower Vivian Larson, this established cut flower farm is a beautiful sight to behold. Viv is a precision grower, someone who cares deeply about her flowers, from the very first seedlings emerging from trays and trays of soil to the voluptuous blooms that are picked with great attention to detail, processed, gathered, and delivered to her design customers. Located about an hour north of Seattle, Everyday Flowers is situated on a gorgeous piece of land with a more than 180-degree view to the Puget Sound's many islands, Camino, Whidbey, the San Juans, all the way up to Canada. And I could see north toward Mount Vernon. It was so beautiful. Vivian and her husband Jim, a commercial fisherman, raised two children here and are now helping raise three grandchildren. It is a bucolic place with a beloved horse who adds agricultural character to the scene, as well as rows and rows of field-grown annuals and perennials located next to several large and very tidy hoop houses containing even more flowers. Vivian is a founding member and board vice president of the Seattle Wholesale Growers Market, and I've known her for several years through that relationship. Some would say she is the glue that holds that place together, a true diplomat when it comes to synthesizing points of view and navigating the true meaning of a cooperative, one that benefits all members for the greater good. Vivian is the daughter of farmers who taught her those intangible skills of building good soil and caring for the land. "I always had a patch of earth where I grew flowers as a child," she recalls. When Vivian's own children were small, in 1990, she asked her husband to prepare a large area of ground. She began growing flowers and selling her bouquets at a nearby farm stand. "People would wait there to get my flowers, or I'd have standing orders," Vivian recalls. "Good flowers sell themselves. I never had to advertise." Experience has taught Vivian to know which varieties are successful as cut ingredients, which colors are reliable over time, and which flowers produce the longest stems. "I've always known there were certain types of flowers that lasted better than others, especially if cut at the right time and treated properly post-harvest," she explains. "The fact is, I have a choice of what to grow, and I choose to grow plants that are going to be happy at my farm and hold well in the vase." For example, Vivian grows larger quantities of white, pink, and yellow lilies because they are more popular with her customers. Similarly, those Karma dahlias, which she has abundant supply of, have been bred for 18 to 20 inch long stems and longer vase life, so Vivian focuses on those. Vivian also has a great idea of what wedding designers and their clients are looking for and how they use each flower. While she has in the past done some of her own design work, the bottom line is that Vivian is first of all a flower farmer. "Honestly, I just enjoy growing them more than anything else," she told me. Please enjoy our conversation. We were lucky to have another guest along for my flower adventure, Alicia Schwede, a floral designer and owner of the Flirty Fleurs blog and a past guest of this podcast, joined Vivian and me for dinner and then returned early the following morning, clippers and urn in hand, for a floral designer's whirlwind session. We loved creating arrangements and bouquets with Vivian's blooms. She let us loose in her fields and let us cut whatever we wanted to create our own bouquets that morning. I'll have bonus photos of my visit and our designs to share with you at deborahprinzing.com. Good morning and welcome back to the Slow Flowers Podcast with Deborah Prinzing. And I am here very early on a Tuesday morning in Stanwood, Washington. Is it Stanwood or Skagit Valley?
My address is Stanwood.
Stanwood, with Vivian Larson, owner of Everyday Flowers. Vivian is a fantastic flower farmer who I've known for years through the Seattle Wholesale Growers Market. And full disclosure, we're on the board together. And I begged Vivian to let me come sort of spend a morning with her, or kind of a day on the life. I wanted to see a day on the life of the flower farm. So it's early. We just got up, and Vivian and I were having some caffeine, and she started to talk about how she became a flower farmer. And I'm like, wait, we have to turn on the recorder. So, Viv, good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you for your wonderful hospitality.
Oh, you're more than welcome. It's always fun to have someone come and stay on the farm.
And walk the fields.
And walk the fields. Yeah.
So tell us a little bit about how you became a flower farmer.
Well, my mother had always done flowers kind of as a job, and I loved them. But as a young mother, I had two children, and it was in the summer. My husband is a commercial fisherman, so he's gone during the summer, and we didn't have any extra cash.
Yeah.
And so if I wanted to take the kids to go have a hamburger or something, it was always I needed a little extra. So I started just putting a few flowers in the vegetable garden, and then I would take them to a small roadside fruit stand and sell the flowers there.
Wow.
And
right in this area. Wow.
And they would, you know, then I'd get a little extra cash, and so it was just a little extra something to have so that the kids and I could have a little treat. Special thing once in a while.
So, like, what varieties were you selling that first year?
It was pretty much your standard. I grew up, you know, Mom had all the different, but the sunflowers, mm-hmm, and the zinnias and your garden varieties.
The real easy-to-grow annuals.
Easy-to-grow, mm-hmm, annuals that you could grow just from seed in the garden. I didn't have a greenhouse then, or the area to start the seeds like I do now.
Wow. You've been growing flowers for
a long time,
two or three decades. Then.
Yeah, we moved on to this farm in 1990.
Okay,
so wow. 1990, and the first thing that I requested that my husband do is dig me up a plot.
Wow.
So I have to have some ground. So that we did, and I grew mainly vegetables for the family, but got to have some flowers in there.
So you just were, that was just your source of fresh vegetables and herbs and for the summer
canning and that kind of thing. Yeah.
So you still weren't growing to really much for commercial sale.
Not commercial sale, huh? But that's when I started. And then it just grew the little, you know, just taking a few bouquets down there, I kind of built I don't want to say cult following,
yeah,
but it was basically people who knew that they would be there, and they sold very well.
So Vivian's bouquets, basically. Everyone knew you.
Everyone knew me. They didn't, they knew that someone brought those bouquets in and they really liked them. And so they sold really well, and it just continued to grow. And it just, I could see the potential in it.
Yeah.
Which was good.
I'm really interested, were you selling straight bunches or designed bouquets?
Designed bouquets.
Oh, so they were really delicate and different and interesting elements.
I got to play with them.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I did, is play with them. It would be, you know, just to, sometimes I think I pushed their limits for roadside stand a bit.
Little high-end roadside.
High-end, yeah.
So what's your style? You can say high-end roadside.
High-end roadside would be, I like that.
What were you charging for them? I bet you charged way less than you should have.
Way less than I should have. I think I sold them to the farmer for $5 a piece.
Mm-hmm. And then was he marking them up to $7.50 or something?
Yeah, and they didn't mark them up very much at all. It, you know, there's a real limit on that type of, they were worth way more than that, but that wasn't the point. It was great just to take them, and it was.
Then go to Dairy Queen with the kids.
And then go to Dairy Queen. It was great. I would do stuff like, I would do an all white bouquet, which, you know,
kind of cutting edge here for the country.
For country. But they all sold. I think it was kind of interesting that people had never seen anything quite like that in a little country store.
And here we are in Stanwood, and we're kind of on the between Snohomish and Skagit counties. And it's the city has moved out here. I mean, this is not as rural as it used to be, but it's still pretty much a lot of people have lots, 20-acre plots, and people are have an agricultural base still. Wouldn't you say if you get away from the freeway?
If you get away from the freeway, and there's little chunks of little farms kind of stuck in, and but the interesting thing about that particular farm stand is that it is on the main road that goes to Camano Island. And there are a lot of people who have summer homes on Camano Island. I mean, there's year-round residents more now than there used to be.
Yeah, but the second home from the city.
But the second home, they come up from the city and they spend. So I think that that was a lot of, that drove a lot of sales at that time, too.
And maybe people who were used to seeing a more sophisticated palette or something.
It's possible, yeah. I think maybe that helped a lot, actually.
So did you have your business name then?
I didn't. My business name was really interesting. It came along probably about 7 years later. And
so 97, 98?
Yeah, something like that. And someone was, they didn't mean it in any way in a derogatory term, but they had said, oh, these are just the everyday flowers that my grandma used to grow, because there wasn't anything that was really different and out there, and you know, they were
familiar.
They were familiar flowers: the sweet peas, the zinnias, the dahlias, the things that people were comfortable with that their grandma had grown in their garden as a cutting garden for years.
But they weren't seeing these in the grocery stores or in the florist shops.
No, they weren't, and those were flowers that, and the ones that I just mentioned. Those are a little less. They don't travel quite as well, so they weren't being shipped in at all. And at that time, there weren't very many small farmers who actually sold in the grocery. So they weren't seeing them in that venue. So in
the varieties
they weren't available then. So
when someone said, "Oh, these are just those everyday flowers," you thought, yeah, that's me, and I'll call my business that.
Yeah, and I liked it that people recognized those flowers. But the interesting thing about those everyday flowers is that the breeding that has gone into them now has changed so much that a lot of people don't even recognize the everyday flowers for what they are.
Mm-hmm. So give me an example, because I know you're very knowledgeable about breeding and seed development.
Well, there's some. We can talk about snapdragons, which everybody has seen snapdragons for years, but there are now varieties that have been bred. They're more of an open face or butterfly snapdragon.
Mm-hmm. And the traditional snapdragon has that little mouth that
and if you squeeze it opens its mouth and it kind of
it's in on itself.
But it's in on itself and it's kind of closed, and then the bee has to wiggle itself in there. Whereas the new ones have more of an open face, look almost like an azalea flower.
Yeah.
And so they're more open face and they're just a little pretty face there. They're really
they're softer.
They're softer. They're more open, and they come in colors that you wouldn't have thought about.
And so the one that you are knocking out of the park at the Seattle Wholesale Growers Market is sort of we were talking with Alicia last night. Is it coral? Is it apricot? Is it salmon? Is it, peach? Well, like, what do you call that one?
All of those.
Okay. Because it has this gradation of color.
It does have this beautiful gradation of color. So a designer can use that in any one of her color palettes and make it work, which is so nice. The one we're talking about specifically is the Tangerine Trumpet is the varietal name of that.
Hmm. And you've gone deep into that variety. You have
I love that variety.
A lot of stock.
Yep. Because it's so useful. So you can use one. You don't have to have orange, and you don't have to have peach, and you don't have to have, so you can have one. You can grow one variety, and it can go, I can get an order for orange, and I can put that with that order. Or I could get an orange for coral, and I can put,
That takes a lot of insight from a flower farmer's point of view to think about what the fashion palette of the
designer is. Yeah, you're right, and I think it's smart to do that. Mm-hmm. I think it's really smart to do that to keep your fingers in the not only the fashion world, but the designer world, or what people are using in their houses as color palettes, mm-hmm. and because that's the colors that they'll gravitate towards.
Yeah,
it's very what they see and what they've got in their house, and they want to have the colors that go with that, and then that's what the brides are all seeing. So you gotta keep your fingers on that.
Well, so we're kind of jumping all over the map. So you fast forwarded to where you are today, mm-hmm. from that roadside high end roadside.
Yeah, that's right. We did. We skipped a couple of years.
So we'll describe growing area you have now, and then we'll fill in the blanks, because I know there's more on your journey that I want to talk about.
Oh, yeah, there's a long journey there. But right now I'm growing on approximately 3 acres and all told. I have two different farm sites, mm-hmm. Site here at our house, and then a site at my mother-in-law's, which is about 5 or 6 miles from here.
And it just has different cultural conditions? Is that
it has different cultural conditions. I grow a lot of dahlias down there. It's right next to the Skagit River. And it doesn't require a lot of watering, because you get
water table.
Yeah, higher water table. So it's in between an old farmhouse and a beautiful old church. And so the setting is beautiful. And so it's really fun to just be down there and be working that land.
But you're back and forth then between
them. So I'm back and forth between the two. On harvest days, we have to plan that we're going to go down there, and we're going to harvest all of everything there and get it back here, get it in the cooler. And it's logistically, you just have to plan it is all. That's not something that every flower farmer does, that kind of thing.
So you've evolved into that this is your full-time business now. This
yes.
is not just mama doing the few flowers on the side. Your kids are grown. You're even a Mimo, which is a grandma, I guess. A very young grandma.
Yes, I have 3 beautiful grandchildren, and they, it was very cute. I had the kids last weekend. I took a video of my 18-month-old granddaughter trying to use the hula hoe, which was hysterical.
What is that?
It's a hula hoe. It's a hoe, uh-huh. and it has a circular saddle type of kind of
a weeder device.
Weeder yeah. device. So it's pushing. So, great big long hula hoe, little 18-month-old trying to push it. And I was trying to just get her to do it. And I'm saying, just push and pull. And it was funny. She tried valiantly to do it, but she got really
You're going to make a flower farmer out of her yet.
Well, I'm hoping that one of them will.
So. Yeah.
They have a great appreciation for it. They do understand. And they always walk up and down the aisles. Even my rambunctious and very energetic 4-year-old grandson knows that he must go up and down and not across the rows.
And to keep the flowers from getting broken or whatever.
To keep the flowers from getting broken. So, they know. They yeah. understand that they're welcome to come in the garden, but there are rules. So,
yeah.
That's my job, and they understand that, and they're very respectful.
That's a great way to grow up, visiting.
Coming out on the farm.
The farm. So, would you say you're a year-round flower farmer? I know you have a lot of season extension strategies, but when do you start your year?
My year starts, I typically start in February, and that's just some greenhouse work, because here in the Northwest, February is one of the coldest and wettest months that we...
Toughest months.
It's an elbow month. It's one of those months that, it wants to have warmth, but there is none, and it's very cold, and we can get still a lot of snow in February. But there are seeds that you need to start in February.
And so this is your greenhouse that you have attached to the back of your barnished garage.
Yeah, we have little names for every one of the structures, so that we kind of know which one we're talking about when we talk about.
So what do you call that one?
That one's called the seed house.
Okay.
Because that's where we start the seeds.
Okay.
So that's it.
And you were saying you can get 2,600 seeds.
26, 24, something about... I start that many about every other week.
Wow.
So in the spring, that's, you start on that, and I know that that's how many I have to put through to be able to stay on schedule to get things in the ground, in the ground at the time they need to.
Okay, so you start those flats.
Mm-hmm.
In the seed house, mm-hmm. in 2 weeks, where do you rotate those out of so you can start your next round of flats?
So then they go into the hoop house.
Okay.
And the hoop house is a small, unheated, well, that's not entirely true because once, sometimes we have to put heat out there, but we just do a small heater, couple little fans. We don't have, and it's just a small...
A pop-up structure kind of thing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. There's no heat. And that basically is, it's just a, it's a hardening off type of structure that gets cooler at night and warmer during the days. And
gets them to the next
stage. Gets them to the next stage or level. And then they'll go outside to finish off their hardening off process. And then they'll go into the ground.
Wow.
So, boom, boom,
if you're starting in February... You're putting seeds in the ground within 4 weeks.
So basically, we're starting in February. Usually it's about 6 weeks when the first, so sometime mid-March is when we try to get all of the sweet peas into the ground. Sweet peas are the first thing that goes into the ground because they require a long time to build a really good, strong root structure, and they like it cold, and they like the cool soil. So we try to plant them at a time when it's still fairly cold, and March is still fairly cold.
Yeah, I always, being a garden writer in the Seattle area all these years, I always remember hearing that your peas go in the ground on St. Patrick's Day, mm-hmm. your edible peas.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess that similar mid-March would be for sweet peas.
Same varietal type of thing. Up here, it's a little later than that.
For, Seattle's probably a half zone warmer.
It's a little warmer. It's a little colder up here.
Zone 7?
Zone 7, 7A. It changes, and also, you know, every little piece of land has its own little microclimate, mm-hmm. and there can be changes on even one piece of property from one little section to another.
Yeah, because you've got the high land and the low land here.
Yeah.
I'm sure that's
and it can be cooler down on the lower part where we put in, but warmer up above in the first little plot because it's a little more protected from the wind.
So sweet peas go in first. Mm-hmm. How many plants did you put in this year?
We did. About 800, which is doesn't seem like very many, but it's quite a few.
Oh my gosh! We're gonna put a this cat.
Oh, I'm sorry.
We got a little kitten here who's biting my heel. when I saw the rose yesterday, and I'll definitely put a picture of Vivian's sweet peas on my show notes. It looks way more than 800 plants because they're so prolific and they're so tall.
Yeah.
And they bloom. You just keep harvesting off the same plants. You're getting multiple cuts off of each vine, right?
Yeah. When you're growing like I do in a space like that, then so when you plant the sweet peas, you've got to have it's a raised bed type of situation. Mm-hmm. So we amend the soil heavily. Sweet peas are heavy feeders for one thing. So they
to nitrogen be a, or
just we do a it's an 8-2-4 or something like that, or it's nature's intent, so it's a nice organic type of fertilizer, and that gets mixed in, and we add new soil into it too, because every time you pull a crop out, then some of the soil is gone too. But we mix it all in, and the plants. When I start the sweet peas, and they come up and pinch out, and then I pinch out the center one so that they branch, and so they're a little bushy plant, so that when they take off, it's not just the one tendril going up; it's more like three or four.
Yeah.
So
wow.
It's and they're happy little plants and ready to grab the netting and go. But we keep them watered very well. Sweet peas require a lot of water; they really want to keep. So we keep them watered. We keep them fed really well. I don't do any additional feeding during the season.
Just give them a good start.
Give them a really good start, really good soil. I think that really good soil is really, if a farmer wants to be, if they want to be successful, you've got to have really good soil. You've got to be a soil steward, I believe.
Oh, my gosh. If you don't start there, then you're wasting all your energy and money.
Exactly. You are. And building the soil is really, it's not difficult. It's just something that you need to be conscious of doing and just be conscious of what the plants need to reward you with good blooms.
Well, those sweet peas, if you have 800, when you talk about the branching, if each one is putting up four or five shoots, that's kind of like creating
creating
thousands
more.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay, so that's first, but then where do the ranunculus fall come in? Because you don't plant them in the February months, but you're harvesting, what, March, April?
Anemone start in April, okay. And then the ranunculus start in May, usually. Well, late April and May. I usually try to hit that Mother's Day, that really sweet spot there for ranunculus.
Absolutely. You know. Actually, and you're harvesting those before you harvest the sweet peas anyway, right?
Yes. So the sweet peas go in first, but they take longer to, I guess not longer if you think of the time that the ranunculus go in. But so there's kind of a dual crop, but the timing of it is that it you know, is progression.
Yeah.
So if we're going to, if we wanted to talk, anemones, ranunculus, and specialty tulips are planted in the fall for me. So I don't pre-chill them. I buy them just regular, plant them in the fall. Usually
the corms
and the bulbs. Mm-hmm. And that starts mid-October. It's usually about 3 weeks of intensive planting to get those all in the ground and tucked in, get them well watered, get them growing. There's a lot of attention that needs to be paid to them.
On the front end.
And then they go to sleep and grow all winter, putting down really good, strong root systems, and which is, I don't grow them as a commercial crop, you know, as a quick commercial crop. Mm-hmm. I give them the winter to grow and mm-hmm. develop and build root structure, which is why they get so big.
They're so voluptuous.
Yes, and that's why they get so big.
So the interesting thing is that you have these high tunnels that are big metal structures with plastic over them, but mm-hmm. the ends are open. So it's not like you're. What is the point of planting the ranunculus and anemones and especially tulips there? Is it just keep the wet off of them?
Yes, it is to keep the wet off of them. The rain here can... So ranunculus and the especially tulips, which are big double tulips, we get so much rain in that early part of the season that... it'll fill up those multi-petaled type of flowers. And so you get all that. And if the rain sits on it and it damages them.
Yeah.
So it's a quality mm-hmm. type of thing. Mm-hmm. And then the soil, it warms the soil up a little quicker in the spring.
Sure. Cause it sort of has this magnifying quality.
Yeah. So it'll warm up a little bit faster. It keeps the rain off and then adds a couple of degrees. And so, you know, it doesn't change the seasonality of it drastically, but it does give it a, it's amazing the difference between what's outdoors and indoors. And it's just the cooling effects of the rain that slows it down a little bit. And so it's...
Well, I thought what you said was interesting, that your ranunculus blooms are so much larger and multi-petaled because they've been in the ground all winter. What's the connection?
It's the size. Because they've been in the ground all winter, they put on a really good, heavy, you know, a very good root structure, and so they can uptake a lot of the nutrients that are in the soil that we have spent years building.
Yeah.
And so they can pull up that. And so it makes a much stronger stem, a beefier stem, and a bigger head. So it makes a bigger head, so, you know, you've got a bigger stem to support that head. Otherwise, if it's a big, heavy head on a tiny little stem,
it'll flop.
So you don't want to do that. That's the main reason for having the root structure, you know, to build them. They grow really well here. They like the cool. They don't like... when they start slowing down, they would continue to grow. If you had a shaded house, they would probably continue to grow much later. But when the nights start to warm up, that's when they start to shut down.
Right. So, when it gets to like 60 in the soil
60 in the soil temperature, when it starts to heat up, then they start to slow down dramatically. So
I love what you said about how you have buttercups in your fields. And so, which of course here is a huge... problem for gardeners.
Yes, it's an invasive weed.
But it's a relative of ranunculus. And
yeah, I just, when I considered growing ranunculus, I looked around and I went, well, it grows, it's a weed. It grows very well here. So I thought,
take note.
Yeah, so just kind of pick something that, you know, there's a lot of domesticated flowers mm-hmm. that have in their, you know, in their parentage way back. They come from weed stock, and we've just we've bred them to be a lovely cut flower. Yeah. But if you take notes of those things that grow really well as a weed that are and do quite well, then those are the types of things that you're most likely have success with.
Right, right.
Because they grow well in that situation. So take note of what you've got around and then find something that's going to do well that in that, you know, it'll grow.
That'll be more ornamental. Mm-hmm.
That will be more ornamental.
So how many varieties of cut flowers do you try to produce each year?
It's interesting because I'm focusing more and more on, you know, the numbers of varieties that I'm growing is going down, but the volume of what I'm doing is going up. So I
noticed that you have discipline. You're not trying to chase every fancy exotic variety. You're thinking, what is going to sell and what do I know my customers want?
And then find something super special in the things that in each one of those categories.
Okay.
So that's kind of where I've tried to make the, so we start early in the season with the ranunculus and the anemones and the tulips. And so, as everybody knows, there's huge tulip growers here in the Northwest, in the Skagit Valley. I mean, they dominate, and they do a really good job, and they've got, you know, it's all mechanized. It's a big, big business. So it's not feasible to try to
take that on.
Yeah, it's not going to work. But so you find a little niche there that doesn't work for them. And what doesn't work for them is the specialty tulips.
And these are like the really fancy multi-petaled and
big doubles. They look like peonies, and the color is amazing, and they continue to open. And, you know, they're not something that people are used to seeing. In fact, they don't even really think they're a tulip.
Right.
They're just, you know, so that's where I focused. I thought, well, let's just focus on that. And so then every year in that, I try to find something new and different in there.
And those are more, I guess, when you think about the production tulips that are coming out of Washington, they mm-hmm. have, you know, kind of pointed head, you know, buds or on
yeah.
the flower, and they're
uh-huh.
straight stems, and they're got beautiful green leaves. I mean, they're just like what a child would draw on a, you know, with
a tulip.
Mm-hmm. You're going to something that's more fashion forward or more feminine, or that, you know, your particular designers you sell to, you know, kind of know who's going to go nuts over this and put it in a wedding bouquet, right?
Yeah. Wedding bouquet, lots of, early in the spring, you know, people love tulips. Tulips are, they're absolutely beautiful.
Yeah.
The colors are amazing. Here in the Northwest, after winter,
we're so hungry for it.
Hungry
yeah.
for that color and this, you know, and the gaudiness of them, you know, a little bit. We want to see it. So that's kind of where I focus to, you know, the color, the varieties. So, mm-hmm. you know, so pick the things that do well here and then go out from there.
I also have witnessed what you do, Viv, is that you're really, in a way, focused on building your shoulder seasons, like the early spring availability, which is when people are coming into the Seattle Wholesale Growers Market and they've just come off of a winter of conifers and twigs, and they're just want something blooming.
Mm-hmm.
So you're kind of feeding that.
Yeah, that's to get back to the question that
yeah.
you asked me, how many months I
yeah.
was actually doing this. So originally I just did it during the summer months. So we would say, let's just say that would be May through September.
Yeah,
the typical summer farming months here in mm-hmm. the Northwest. But with the high tunnels that I've got, I can extend those seasons. So we're talking shoulder, you mm-hmm. said shoulder mm-hmm. months or shoulder seasons. So I start earlier, and so I'm able to get a crop to market in April, and then
if the holidays line up, you've got Easter and Mother's Day satisfied,
exactly, uh-huh. which is very, very nice. And so then, you know, then you move into your summer crops, and then I've also done late crops. So with the high tunnels, I'm able to do I do lisianthus,
mm-hmm.
which are very difficult to grow outdoors here, but do well inside. In the high tunnels, in the raised beds where it's warmer.
They're looking pretty healthy yesterday. They're not, they're what, like 6-8 inches tall?
They're, and I'm always envious of growers in the Midwest who in July have all these beautiful lissies that they have all over Facebook, and I'm just like, oh, but not here in the Northwest. We just don't. It takes longer.
You don't get the heat.
We don't get the heat, so you gotta wait. You gotta be a little more patient. And
so, when will you have the Lysianthus in September?
In September.
Wow. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of a nice rose alternative.
It's a very nice rose alternative, and it's a very nice addition. And so, a lot of people have they've come to expect them, and they're, you know, I it's always interesting. I tend to get some orders for it. Oh, I want your lissies again this year, and I've got a wedding coming up in July, and I just have to respond and say, you got to be patient. Mm-hmm. Got to be patient. They'll be here, but you got to wait. And then it's the thing about the Northwest, gardening in the Northwest, and it's intense. I would say it's intense because all the seasons and all the things that you grow are season's shorter, but it's compacted. You know, they're beautiful, but it's compacted into a short season and then it's gone.
Right.
So it's a short season and then it's gone. So all these varieties.
So you have these bursts of particular rock stars, but they only last bursts of fabulousness, right?
Yeah, bursts of fabulousness, and they don't last a long time. So if you see, so the designers have to be, they have to be really flexible. So they have to be able to say, well, okay, I'm going to use this, and, you know, or they remember it from the year before. Mm-hmm. So they have to remember what was it, you know, and
then plan for it.
And then plan for it, or just be really flexible to say, and there again, you know, that's hoping that they have a very flexible bride or someone that they're working for that would be able to just be, let's go with that flow. Let's whatever is there. I know it'll be fabulous. You know, kind of outlook.
But you still try to satisfy people. Like when you showed me those bluish sweet peas, and you're like, yes. I'm trying to hold these for August 3rd wedding or something like that.
August 6th, and I don't know.
Six.
It's
okay.
You know, it's gonna be hard. And so basically, what we do is we keep them really. So we keep them picked because you got to keep the sweet peas picked. So we keep them picked and we keep them well watered, and hope that it's not going to be 90 degrees for six more days or something like that, because that's really hard on the sweet peas.
They keep that florist happy though.
Well, yeah. And she's, you know, she had shown those to a prospective bride and done a mock-up of what they would, you know, and it was in there, and it wasn't that she planned on that being, you know, it was just something blue. Well,
The bride fixated
on it and said, oh my gosh, that, you know, they're one of my favorite flowers. We just have to have those in there. So then you're like, oh, so we'll do the best we can.
Yeah.
We'll do the best we can, but there's no, I mean, I've already had the discussion with her, like, oh.
That's okay. No, I think it's funny. We're hearing the kitten play with a toy on the hardwood floor here.
He found a Lego. That the grandkids left.
That's cute. So Viv, I wanted to ask you before we wrap up, because we've had such a good talk. Before, you're a founding member of the Seattle Wholesale Growers Market, and
yes.
That was founded in 2011.
Mm-hmm.
I know there was maybe a year of planning before that.
Probably not a full year.
Okay.
It was more like
summer of 2010.
I think it was June was when we first started talking about it at the Northwest Regional Meeting for the Association of Specialty Cut Flower Growers.
I was there. I remember.
Yeah,
that.
Yeah.
Eugene, right?
Yes, at Charles Little and Company. They had hosted. They hosted us.
It's fine. I think it's funny.
But then we got back together. We said, there's no way we can do this before summer because we were already deep into our season.
Sure.
So then we got back together that October, and things were just fast-tracked from there. It just went crazy. And so we actually were open for business, much smaller degree than we are now, but the following spring.
Yeah, I remember that. April of 2011.
Yeah, and it was just, you know, what happened in between there. It's still mind-boggling to me that we got as far as we did.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So before you got involved in this co-op with other flower farmers, which I think has been greatly successful and has really changed your business.
Exactly.
How were you selling? How were you bringing your flowers to market for like in the first half of, all of the 2000s, first decade of 2000?
I did a lot of, I did farmer's market. I did farmer's market in Mount Vernon. And it had a very loyal following of people who would buy my flowers. And I
like
did
a Saturday market?
Saturday market, mm-hmm. Just your regular farmer's market. Mm-hmm. And then I sold to different farm stands, and also to, you know, brides find me. They come to the market, they see your flowers, they talk to you about it. So you give them, you know, so I would do a lot of buckets, and then I ended up in doing a lot of actual wedding work for people, which I love the designing part of it, but the work that goes into it is not conducive to farming.
Yeah.
So it's kind of like, if unless you really want to be a masochist and wear both hats, it's kind of pick or choose one or the other.
Yeah. You're definitely know you're a farmer, not a floral
designer. I'm a farmer. I love the designing and I love wandering around the fields and putting things together. But I really am a farmer. I love the soil. I love growing the things that then the designers do gorgeous stuff with.
I can tell you're just so knowledgeable and it's obviously years of experience that you've trial and error and you've created a process that really produces healthy, beautiful specialty flowers. These are not your everyday flowers, really, in a way. They're exceptional flowers.
Yeah, they are. And that's the thing too. I mean, it's like, it's an everyday flower, mm-hmm. but, you can make something spectacular out of it. And, the lowly zinnia is not just, you know, bright yellow splashes of orange. I mean, they, like I said earlier, the breeding that's gone into them, there's some real specialty things out there. So,
yeah, you really own the zinnia category too. I mean, you've really found some gorgeous varieties.
Some gorgeous varieties. And there's, you know, that's the fun of it. It's just picking and choosing and concentrating on those things and then doing them very well.
So not
trying to have too many fingers in the pie, but just picking and choosing and making things and then doing all of those things very well. And that's just what I've tried to do.
Mm-hmm.
Not trying to be all over the board, but just to have certain crops and fill in that gap and then just do it well and do it big.
Well, if anyone's in Seattle, they can come to the Seattle Wholesale Growers Market, and Vivian is there usually one day a week.
Yeah,
you can maybe get to meet her and see her flowers.
Yeah, certainly on Wednesdays, and then for the public, too, on Fridays. So I try to be there on Fridays for public hours. It's a lot of fun for people to be able to see what... it's really nice because they get to see the flowers and purchase the flowers that they can use them for possible, you know, for their own uses. A lot of brides are doing that, and it's really fun to see them just be so amazed by what's there. And when you say, well, it's a snapdragon, and they're like, that's a snapdragon, or, you know, that's a zinnia, and they can't believe that what that is the flower that they...
So when you're talking to these members of the public who come in on the Friday hours, mm-hmm. do they realize you're one of the farmers, that you've grown those flowers? Do you tell them that? Or are you kind of shy about it?
I'm kind of shy about it. I like to help them. A lot of times they think I'm staff. And that's okay, because it doesn't really matter to me that they know that I'm a farmer. Although if they say, well, you know, sometimes they'll ask.
Yeah.
And
you need a big t-shirt that says, I'm a flower farmer.
I'm a farmer. But... I think it's a lot of fun just to talk with them and be able to guide them through a process that and helpful to them to be able to make their whatever it is that they're planning more of a success. I enjoy doing that. I enjoy making people happy with flowers, and I guess that's why we're all there.
That's the teacher in you.
I think so. Yeah.
Well, Viv, thank you so much for chatting for this podcast.
No,
and we're
going
to have lots of photos of your beautiful flowers, and we're going to do a little work. I don't think I'm that helpful, but I'll try to stay in the aisles like your 4-year-old grandson.
I'll give you the talk.
Okay. Thanks so much, Viv.
Thank you, Deborah.
Everyday Flowers uses sustainable growing practices, and the farm is Salmon Safe certified. No herbicides are used on Vivian's farm, and on the rare instance when insecticides are used, they are approved by the Organic Materials Review Institute, Vivian explains. I have good beneficial insect populations, including bees and ladybugs, and I grow cover crops to suppress weeds and add more organic matter back into the soil. Then she adds, I also have Sassy, my horse, who does her share by producing great compost. Which is true. I saw it. Thank you so much for joining us. I hope you take time to visit DeborahPrinzing.com for images, links, and more details about Vivian Larson and Everyday Flowers. And thanks to listeners like you, this podcast has been downloaded more than 16,000 times. I truly appreciate the guests, listeners, and sponsors who have supported the Slow Flowers podcast. Together, we're changing the broken floral industry for the better. If you like what you hear, please consider logging on to iTunes and posting a listener review. And until next week, please join me in putting more American-grown flowers on the table, one vase at a time. The Slow Flowers podcast is engineered and edited by Hannah Holtgertz and Andrew Wheatley. Learn more about their work at hhcreates.net.